This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Alex Steffen, an environmental journalist, consultant, and public speaker. Alex is co-founder of worldchanging.com and editor of the 2006 book World Changing, A User's Guide for the 21st Century. Alex Steffen is here today to tell us about the revised and updated edition of World Changing, published in 2011. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
What is the goal of the new edition of World Changing? What is your purpose in putting the book together?
Well, since 2006, when we released the first version, a lot has changed, and the sustainability movement has evolved, and we are in a position where many of the things that we covered in the first edition, some of the personal choices, some of the sort of small actions that one can take, are really well known now. And so in looking to revise and update the book, we realized that we needed to move in a more systemic direction and help people see larger systems as well as sort of new solutions that just weren't around when we started.
Would you expand on how the world is different now than when you wrote the first edition?
Well, I think one of the ways that things are different is that the word has really gone out, right? People are very aware of the problems, very aware of some of the smaller solutions that are available to them. And what is lacking now is perhaps a more comprehensive vision of the kinds of actions we need to take. As well, the problems are more pressing. So we know now that we need to really step up the kind of action we're doing. 5 years ago, we might have been able to talk about climate action in general terms. Now we really know that we need to think about 350 as a target. 5 years ago, we might have been able to talk about greening construction in general terms. Now we really need to think about passive house design or living building standards. There's been a step up in the demands for what we need to do. So we really wanted to bring all of that kind of information together in one place and give people a real sense of what actual bright green living would be like.
Would you give an overview of the 2011 edition of World Changing and tell us how it's organized and the topics that are covered?
So the book starts with the topics that are closest to us, most intimately connected to our lives. The products we use, our consumption patterns, the ways we shop and provide for our needs. And from there, it gradually steps out in concentric rings. So from there, we talk about buildings and our homes and workplaces, the energy systems and the water systems around us, the larger urban patterns we're a part of, our neighborhoods and our cities, the communities in which we're engaged, which are, of course, these days both local and global, and then politics and business as ways to connect to the larger whole. And then we end with a long chapter on the planet and really connecting with the idea that we live on a planet with very finite limits and that we're all responsible now for being aware of that.
Who contributed to the book?
There are scores of authors drawn from World Changing's team, many of whom are specialists in one field or another, journalists covering a specific topic. Sort of our two newest additions are Van Jones and Bill McKibben, who wrote the foreword and the introduction, respectively. But we have also, you know, a number of writers, including Alan Atkison, including Leif Utney, another local person, and so on and so forth.
What is your view of what a bright green future will look like? What is your vision?
Well, I think that we need to start by recognizing that we live on a planet which is already more than half urban. You know, more than half of the human population now lives in cities. By 2050, about 70% of the world's population will live in large cities, and about 95% of humanity will live within a day's travel of a city. So we are really overwhelmingly becoming an urban species. That means that sustainability is an urban challenge. That doesn't mean that forests and farms are unimportant, but it means that the real leverage point for changing the way that we interact with the planet is here in the cities that we live in. That being the case, we really need to start engaging with how we plan and build our cities, the kind of transportation choices we make, the kind of infrastructure we use. And I think that what we're going to find is that we're gradually moving towards a carbon neutral kind of sense, where we are much more focused on pedestrian-oriented communities, much more focused on experiences rather than consumption, where we have high density but also very green and leafy communities, and where we are very specifically grounded in our place but have strong and ethical connections to farmers and foresters and so forth all around the world.
What are some of the best overall strategies or approaches to a more sustainable world illustrated in your book?
You know, of course, there are over 1,000 entries in the book, so there are many things there. But I think one of the things that we really have tried to focus on is the degree to which we now have better systemic solutions for almost all our problems, whether we're talking about the way we provide energy and moving towards a clean energy economy, or the way we organize our cities and moving towards a pedestrian-focused, transit-oriented kind of community, the way we grow our food, and so on. There, all of these things, we have the ability to change the systems around us. And we now, if we are serious about sustainability, need to become advocates for actual system change.
Would you comment on what you say is the need to synthesize the local and the global, to combine a focus on individual ecosystems with a focus on the biosphere as a whole?
Yeah, we know now that we're all in this together, that issues like climate change and other planetary boundaries are simply not solvable by any one group of people and affect all groups of people in all places. That means each of us and each of our communities has a global responsibility. At the same time, of course, we live in specific places. And so we have a responsibility as well to start thinking about those places and how they can either help to provide zones of stability and balance, or how we maybe need to restore the systems around us, which in an era of climate change and rapid transition may not mean restoring it to what was there, but rather starting to have climate foresight and look ahead and become adaptive to the challenges we know we've already set in motion.
How do you personally approach trying to balance the global and the more local?
Well, it's a bit of a challenge. My career is very global. I do much of my work in Europe, but of course, my roots are here, and I live in Columbia City. I'm very proud and happy to be a Seattleite. The way I've tried to bring some of that in myself is trying to advocate for Seattle becoming a carbon neutral city itself. I really think that we have the opportunity here, and the city council has begun to respond. We have a growing citizens movement around this. I think we have the opportunity here to really show leadership on a global scale by dramatically reducing our emissions as a city as a whole.
Well, one of the categories you cover in your book is politics. Would you like to highlight what you consider to be the most effective political approaches to world changing?
Well, I think that part of what we're learning, and we're seeing it live now in the Middle East, is that there are incredible movement building tools and techniques now. Citizens' movements are growing stronger and more able to rapidly form and adapt. That gives us some leverage against some very powerful vested interests that are wealthy and concentrated in their aims. We know that there are all sorts of tools, from citizen media to working with local data in a government 2.0 approach, to thinking differently about how we confront those with power in terms of using nonviolence and applied pressure to force changes. And I think it's a really exciting time where we see, on the one hand, these tremendous problems, but on the other hand, an interconnected set of global movements for democracy, human rights, sustainability, and development that is much larger than anything the world has ever seen before.
Do you think that the current political efforts are more likely to be successful than those in the past?
Well, I think here in the U.S., we face a particular problem where we have deeply, deeply entrenched interests that are working directly against change on sustainability. In particular, we have oil companies, including the Koch brothers. We have coal companies. We have car companies. And we have sprawl developers, all of whom are really fighting tooth and nail to prevent any change from happening. I don't know that we'll see much progress on the federal level in the next few years, which is why I think it's even more important that we really look at regional, state, and local efforts. And we're starting to see some really dramatic stuff happening. There's regional greenhouse emissions efforts. There's state laws in a number of states that are quite promising. California's really been leading the way. And of course, there are local efforts. And because cities are such a leverage point for changing our emissions, local efforts actually can have a big impact. So we know that there are cities in Europe already that have committed to becoming completely climate neutral, or at least net climate neutral when they balance everything they do. And there's no reason why Seattle couldn't follow in that footsteps. I think we could become climate neutral by about 2030. And that's the goal I keep pushing. If we were to do that, we would, of course, not only reduce our own emissions, which are real, but we would also start to develop tools, techniques, and models that we can then share with other people. Here's how we did it. Here are the designs we used. Here are the green building practices. Here are the codes we wrote for our government, and et cetera. And those things are important. We need pioneers in those regards. So while we may not be able to change much at the federal level right now, I think the local level is still a real zone of opportunity.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Alex Steffen, editor of the revised and updated edition of World Changing, a user's guide for the 21st century. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you expand on some of the specific movements that you think are particularly making a difference?
Yes, I think that one of the movements that's really been most encouraging is green building, which is both a professional effort and a political effort, right? Because in many places, what's happening is we're trying to change the actual building codes. There are, of course, many people already embracing basic standards, Energy Star, LEED, these sorts of things. But there are now these more aggressive standards, these more innovative standards like Passive House, which aims to have a home that is completely heated and cooled by the sun and breezes, so you don't even need a furnace or an air conditioner, which dramatically reduces the amount of energy that a home uses. And I think that we are starting to see those kind of ideas much more rapidly taken up and encouraged by local governments and pushed forward by visionary architects and designers. And I think that's a really great model for how change can rapidly spread through a profession.
Are there additional movements you'd like to mention?
Yes, I think we're also seeing some really brilliant work being done with local food. In particular, I think people who are realizing that the level at which we most need to work is the level of the food shed, right? Not just sort of local in the sense of very local, but local in the sense of the region around us and supporting farmers and farmland preservation and stopping sprawl. And there's a very healthy movement here in Seattle that is, you know, working on everything from growth management to farmers markets. And we can all, I think, help that movement grow. There's also a really terrific movement afoot globally and nationally to really re-emphasize smart communities, smart growth, really start to talk about transit-oriented development, really start to push forward high-density, high-quality-of-life ways of living. And we know that that is ultimately the single most important thing that we need to do, that if you are going to choose one strategy to reduce our ecological impacts, it would be to bring people into more compact living. That more of us living in relatively compact, walkable communities means fewer of us driving. When we drive less distance. We tend to live in smaller homes. We tend to live in multi-unit homes, which are much more efficient. We tend to use transit more. We tend to own fewer things because when you live in a, you know, walkable community, in a smaller bungalow, say, it doesn't make any sense to have a home gym, for example. Right? You belong to a gym that you walk to, which means that you are, compared to owning a home gym, saving huge amounts of material energy by simply not having bought that in the first place, right? It gives us access to things like tool sharing. It really can change our whole pattern of living, especially with new technologies that are making urban life easier. And so I think that one of the things that's really exciting to me is that there's this movement afoot to really help us reimagine the way we live in cities to be much more urban and much more sustainably urban.
Would you expand on the role of technology in creating a more sustainable future?
I think technology and design are absolutely fundamental. I think, though, that we need to recognize how we ought to go about solving problems. There's a tendency to want to engage in what I call the swap, which is to look at how we live in, say, a suburban lifestyle now and try and imagine, you know, sort of upgraded replacements for all the individual pieces there. And that strategy doesn't tend to work, right? If we're talking about an auto-dependent community, simply swapping out electric cars will not make that community sustainable, If we're talking about a high consumption, consumerism-oriented society where people buy enormous volumes of things, making those things themselves slightly more sustainable will not make much of a difference, right? I think the first step is recognizing that we want to not just have improved means to unimproved ends, but actually improve the ends themselves. And we know that, in fact, it's possible to design away the need for things while leaving us with more money and a higher quality of life. So, you know, again, back to the example of consumption. Right now, many of us buy power tools, other home improvement tools in great numbers. Most of us don't use them very much, right? The typical home drill gets used somewhere between 6 and 20 minutes in its entire lifetime. Yet many of us, millions of us, have drills at home that are waiting to be used. One answer would be to design a more sustainable drill. But that would still mean that there are tens, if not hundreds of millions of unused sustainable drills sitting around. A much more effective means of delivering the same solution is to have access to a tool sharing library, a tool rental service, and so on. Technology can then enable us to design that service in a much more effectively deliverable way, right? So there's, for example, a site, Neighbor Goods, which helps people connect to their neighbors and to easily share the things they want. So they don't have to put an ad in the paper or something like that. They just go on the site, they find out, oh, my neighbor three doors down has a drill that they're willing to let me use. And that kind of thing, I think, can really revolutionize the way we live.
Would you please discuss how the concept of zero impact will help shape a more sustainable future?
Ultimately, because we live on a finite planet, we will need to reach a point where we are having no negative impact on the planet at all, especially because much of the impact that we're currently having is impact that we don't know if it can be repaired. Sooner or later, we're going to have to imagine our society floating on nature, right? Being so light in its impacts that they're essentially negligible, perhaps even being restorative. And we're starting to see glimmers that we can, in fact, do this, that there are ways that we can produce goods and food in zero waste cycles, right? So that everything we use is returned into a productive system. We are beginning to understand that there are ways that we can live with zero emissions, carbon neutrality. And we're beginning to understand that there are even ways that we can take some of the fundamental things that are currently deeply wrong with our society, for example, our use of toxic chemicals, and really reimagine how they work through green chemistry, biomimicry, and simple design substitution. And so I think that while it's really difficult to imagine this today for many of us, the reality is that we're closing in on the possibility of living a relatively prosperous, very enjoyable, high quality of life kind of lifestyle that has no impact at all on the planet. And that's what we ought to be shooting for.
In the newly published edition of World Changing, you comment on the need to feed optimism and do away with pessimism and cynicism to solve the world's problems. Would you explain?
Well, I think that it is very easy to look at the scope, scale, and speed of the problems we face and to begin to despair. I think it is also very easy to look at the degree of greed and corruption that we face in politics and commercial life and to grow cynical about people and their willingness to change. I think, though, that we need to acknowledge that both despair and cynicism don't serve us very well, and that, in fact, they are actively encouraged by many of the people who most want to see the status quo perpetuated. One of our biggest challenges is that we don't have a very clear vision of the future or the possibilities in front of us, and we certainly don't have a political consensus yet on those possibilities. That makes it very hard to get things done, right? Because as Buckminster Fuller said, people never leave a sinking ship until they see the lights of another ship on the horizon, right? And as long as people are focused on the fact that the ship is sinking and they're in, you know, in despair and panic and cynicism, then you can't get them to actually start to make changes. There is another option, which is to engage in a politics of optimism, to look at the problems we face and acknowledge their severity and acknowledge the speed in which they're closing down on us, but then to start to also think in a solutions-based way where we start to articulate to our fellow citizens what we could be doing instead and start to point out the places where it's practically working or where it's practical and working. and to share with them the possibilities of transformation. That has a much more powerful effect on politics. And in places where that debate has been taken up, especially Northern Europe, the effect on politics has been nothing short of transformative.
What's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
We hope that people will engage with the book, World Changing, A User's Guide for the 21st Century. I welcome people to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Alex Steffen, AlexSteffen. And, you know, I welcome people's feedback.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Alex.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to Alex Steffen, editor of the revised and updated edition of World Changing, A User's Guide for the 21st Century, published in 2011 by Abrams. For more information, check on the web at www.alexsteffen.com. Again, that's Alex, Steffen.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.